Is that the end, guys?
Yeah,
it is. It's Hot and Cold. It's Saturday morning. It's me, Tom. It's that was the band. You knew that. You've been around long enough. And okay, we've got a tropical storm. Okay, got a tropical storm. It has inundated and done catastrophic things all up and down the East Coast. It's a let me underline this, capital T tropical storm. So why is it so cold out this morning? I walk out into the cold rain of September. Now it's not atypical for September, but it's a tropical storm. So, oh well, it is Maine, and we hardy folk accept that. And I got to wear a fancy shirt this morning because I could wear a long sleeve shirt because the tropical storm is here, and I have to stay warm. Oh my! I guess we could use the rain. I guess I don't know. I think we've had enough rain. So anyway, so what do we got? Stuff. You know, we moved our business in June, beginning of June. We were in a new location, and now it is beginning of September. So what is that? We got all of June, all of July, all of August, 3 months, one quarter of a year. We've been moved out, and I had one car that I had left over there, which was a Nissan Altima hybrid that didn't run. It runs electrically. It won't run. The gas motor wouldn't start. And I've kind of parked it and said, hey, leave it over there. And so the folks wanted me to move it. So my friend Nat and I, and there seems to be a subtext to my friendship with Nat, is that we get to do interesting things together. So we towed the car out. I brought my truck over and we hooked the strap to the car and we pulled it out front. Get it, because the guy where we had it parked, the guys wanted to clean up stuff and do things. So we moved the car out, and I was over there yesterday briefly, and somebody said, "When are you going to move the car?" And I gritted my teeth and I said, "Soon." And anyway. I mentioned it to Nat, and he says, "Well, let's put a strap on it and tow it down Route 1," which is what we did. And you know, I was thinking, well, we could do that. It'd be ideal to do it sometime when there's not a lot of traffic, but we did it around noontime on Friday. It went fine. I'm sure you're going to hear something from Pete about that if he calls in this morning, because Pete being my son, in some ways takes after me, in some ways takes after my wife. He's a little more conservative about things that my wife would shake her head at and say, "Oh, why did you do that?" So, but the car's over there, and I will work on it now because it's going to be staring me right in the face every day. So we will get it running and get it the heck out of the way. The comment was made that you and Nat is not a good combination. Having said that, Nat has bought I think it's a 1926 Dodge, which I will report on as time goes on. He was thinking of driving it back from where he bought it, and I advised all of a sudden I'm the voice of reason. That's not a good start to the day, boys and girls. I said, "Nat, it's a 1926 car. It is what? 90? Yeah, it's 90 some years old. I'm not sure I would drive it back." So I've convinced him of that. So, but we're not going to hook a strap to it either. We'll see. We'll report back on that. I mentioned last week that we had a lift coming into our shop, and it arrived this week, and it is mostly, it is all assembled. It is all together. And, it went reasonably well. The directions weren't the clearest, but a lift is not that complicated. And, Pete and I finished it up yesterday morning and actually made it operate. It's not ready to put cars on yet, but it will be maybe later today. And but the basically, this is called a single post lift, and a single post lift is basically a very, very heavy duty pallet jack that with one post and arms that come out to lift, and it's good for small cars, which is what I work on. So, and it's portable. You can move it around the shop, which it was a critical feature for me. So our shop's not that big. But the post, it comes knocked down. So it comes on a pallet that weighs 1,800 pounds. And they tell you when you buy it, you have to have a way to offload it. So I borrowed Nat's forklift and drove it down Route 1 to my shop. And I found out something interesting. I checked with the town constable in Stockton Springs, and the town office said to call the sheriff's department. I called the sheriff's department and said, hey, I got to drive. I want to drive this thing down a quarter mile. Is that okay? They said, yeah. It's industrial equipment. You could ride it in and drive it down in the breakdown lane. I said, this is a great country. So I drove a forklift a quarter mile down Route 1, brought it in, and we offloaded the thing. And there's a reason a forklift might not work where we are, because we're not paved. And without having pavement, it's very easy to bury the forklift, which I've only done once. We only had to hook it to the pickup truck once to pull it out. But we got the thing in the building and got it unloaded. And there's basically three basic components. There's the lifting part that goes under the car. There's the base structure, which is kind of like the pallet jack thing. And then there's a post. And the post is vertical. And the post is the heaviest part. And the post comes laying down flat on the pallet. And it weighs about 350 pounds. So the post has to be made vertical. And therein comes the application of physics. But we have to take a break. So we'll take the break. When we come back, we will... We will discuss the physics of such of that practical physics. That's what was done this week. Practical physics with Tom. It's hot and cold. It's Saturday morning. Stay with us. 8:15. We'll be right back. Hey, it's 8:20. It's hot and cold. It's the big rock and roll radio. No, that's Mike Dow. I'm sorry. Mike's in the next studio doing diligence is what he's doing. He's writing next week's column for the Main Edge. And it's always great to come in on Saturday morning and have Mike here to chat with for a while. Talking music is what we do. All right. Okay. We'll turn down the Molly Hatchet. And we'll. Hey, so hey, I got a text message here. The text line is 601-207-4478 from Tom up in Guilford. And Tom, you know, you're not helping me here, buddy. It says, Tom, it's illegal to tow with a chain or a strap. Must be fixed a rigid tow connector. All right. Well, look, I called the sheriff, and he said it was okay to drive the industrial piece of equipment. I never asked about towing. So I had plausible deniability, I think, up to the point you just sent me the text message. Now, you know, who knows who's listening? The sheriff in Waldo County is probably listening. And next time I tow something with a strap, I'm in trouble. That being said, I usually use a tow service, but this was just one. My teeth were gritted. I was vexed, is what I was. You know, move your car. What's that all about? So thank you. It's good to have that. You know, it's always good to have the voice of reason occasionally there. So, let's see. What else? Oh, so I was driving through Bangor this morning, and something caught my eye. It was the roof of a house, and I looked up. It was just a standard gable-end house. I looked up at the roof caught my eye because it was light-colored, and I look up, and it is spray-foamed. Somebody has spray-foamed the outside of the roof. So I have to slow down and turn around and look, because I'd gone by. Take another peek. And what they had done, apparently, was a two-story house. Now, this is 2.5 stories up in the air. This has been done. Strip the old roof off, put rafters on top of the roof, and cross pieces, and spray foamed in between. And I assume they're going to put a metal roof on. Maybe they're going to put a shingle roof on top. I don't know what they're doing, but and I'm thinking, well, that's kind of cool. You know, you got spray foam. There's industrial applications where you have you can actually spray foam a roof. You could put a weathering surface on top of it, and that's the roof. And it's fast and it's easy, and you know, it is what it is. But that's for a flat, usually used on a flat roof building. So I'm looking at this. I'm thinking, well, what is wrong with this picture? There's something bothering me about this picture, and I'm like, it's spray foam. So let's get the most expensive foam we can get and spray it on the roof. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with spray foam. It's a great product. It seals well. Everything is sealed. But let's stop and think about it for a minute and the cost involved here to get a given result. And let's say for the sake of discussion, it's R40 that got added on to the top of the building. So some poor schmo had to get up on that roof, which is, you know, over 20 feet off the ground. And it's a 12-12 roof, so it's 45-degree roof pitch. And strip the old roof off. And people do that every day. It's expensive. Okay? Okay, then they framed the roof with, they laid new rafters, 2x6s, on the roof. Then they put cross pieces in, because I think they're probably going to put a metal roof on, so you need to have horizontal pieces to screw your roof to. And then they spray foamed it. Now, I was doing this, and I was using spray foam. Okay, I would put down the rafters, and instead of cutting and fitting pieces in between, which is a thermal bridge, let's put a 2x4 on top of the edge, the top edge of the 2x6 rafters, and you have a full space now, full cavity that spray foam. Quicker and easier, does the same thing, gives you a little more space actually, and there's no less thermal bridging. But spray foam is, let's say for the sake of discussion, $1 a board foot. So that's 1 square foot, 1 inch thick. I have a feeling they may have charged a little extra because it's 25 feet in the air to do this on the outside. You know, it's standing, you know, you're not standing in the attic spraying up. You're on the outside spraying down. So you have to have some kind of lift to get up there. Extra expense. And if it's R40, it's 5.5 inches of foam, so it's $5.50 at least per square foot. Okay, so let's look at this in another way. We still pay somebody to get up on the roof, strip the old roof off. So now we're looking at the old roofing boards. We got a substrate that you can fix structure to. Different approach, same better result. In my simple mind. And that is, you go to Home Depot, you go to Hammond Lumber, you go to the lumber yard, and you buy, let's say, 2-inch foam. 4x8 sheets. It's not cheap. It's not cheap anymore. But let's say it's $50 a sheet. Is it $50 a sheet? So it's $50 a sheet. Let's a simple number. Got 32 square feet, 2 inches thick. So one board foot of that is, so if we divide 32 into 50, what do we get? $1.25, something like that, per square foot. Divide that by 2 because we have 2 board feet in every square foot of foam. So it's 60-some cents a board foot. It's probably a little less, but let's call it 60 cents a board foot versus a dollar maybe plus a board foot. Now, somebody has to put it on the roof, but you're putting full sheets on the roof, 3 layers. Okay, let's do 6 inches. We'll do 3 layers. And if you apply that foam, full sheets, and then get your 2x, let's say we use 2x4s. You could use 1x2s or 1x3s strapping and screw through the foam into the roof through the strapping you have the same net result, except you do not have the thermal bridging of the framing, the wood framing. You have a better insulation package for less, potentially less money. It's certainly going to cost a little more in maybe in labor because you've got somebody has to be up there still 25 feet off the ground. But you're paying a guy on a spray rig to be 25 feet off the ground, and you still have to get people up there to do the framing initially. So all of that enters into the equation. But I would say that you can get a better result for less money if you understand, if you did a little research and thought about what it is you're trying to do here, which is insulate the roof. And I understand that, and it's great. It's certainly better than it was, but they're not done yet. I drove by this house this morning, and it's just spray foam up there right now. So I assume somebody's coming with metal roofing to screw down next week, maybe. And it'll be nice when it's done, and it won't be dealing with it again. But it's not going to be a cheap date in any way, shape, or form. But if you're going to spend that kind of money, you want to get the best result possible. And a full layer of foam without thermal bridging is better than a layer of foam with a lot of thermal bridging. And there's a lot of thermal bridging here. It's 2 foot on center, I think. And maybe every 2 feet, maybe 3 feet, there's a cross piece. A lot of work went into doing that, and I'm impressed. Either way, somebody's dedicated to the concept. But spray foam is not necessarily the end all and be all for every application, and this was one where it wasn't necessary to do that, and it cost. I appreciate the fact that somebody's willing to pony up the money, but you're paying for that money. You might as well make the best investment possible. So here's the deal. Today, I've got a couple of other things I want to talk about in terms of the actual cost of doing things and the reality versus sometimes the hype, sometimes the BS, sometimes the misrepresentations that come forth. So we will discuss this. After we take another break, oh my goodness, already it seems like we just took one, but I guess that's the deal. It's hot and cold. It's Saturday morning. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a bit. Let me get the phone number, 1-800-966-1039. Text line 601-207-4478. Stay with us. And we're back. It's 8:34 here at the Voice of Maine. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Good morning again. I'm Tom. Before I go to tell you about my friend Alan, we got a couple of text messages here. One, metal roofing is supposed to be strapped. The airspace helps it breathe. What's your opinion on dense packed cellulose? Yes, I think I said it had to be strapped, didn't I? I mean, did I have a lapse there? It has to be strapped horizontally. And I said, if you put sheet foam up, you strap it horizontally. You don't need an airspace with metal roofing if you've got foam underneath it. It's not necessary. Dense pack cellulose is a great investment. If there's an application where you can use it, use it. Thanks for swaying me in the direction of wool wax. We got a 10% coupon and free shipping I found by using Google. A guy bought 5 gallons of it. Now there's dedication. Either that or you have a fleet. And one more here. Is there a way to open the heat pump flow adjuster on my hybrid after the control panel is broken, outdated? I don't know. Appears to fail closed after hot wire. I'm not sure what that means, but heat pump control is fairly simple. So, and just a quick thumbnail. You've got 3 components you run for the heat pump. You've got a fan, you've got a compressor, and you got a circulator pump. If it's a hybrid water heater, you just have a fan and the compressor. I don't think there's a circulator pump in those units. So the two or three components, if it's got all three, well, everything runs the same time while it's heating. If it has to go into defrost mode, it shuts off the compressor and or circulator pump, and the fan continues to run and uses the air, room temperature air, to defrost the unit. And there'd be a control there to operate that. Maybe you would have to put in your own defrost sensor to make that happen. But that's as far as I'm going to go on that one, because I'm not I've not laid hands on the inside of one of those units. But the answer, the short answer is you can rewire it to make it work if it's just a control issue. Okay, so I just want to mention my friend at General, speaking of fixing things, over General Appliance and Brewer on Center Street, open 9 to 4 Monday through Friday. If you're looking for parts or service for your home appliances, visit Alan or call him at 989-4341. And you'll save time, you'll save money, and you'll get the thing fixed. And that's what it's all about, making sure the appliances are working right. 989-4341 is the magic number. Okay. So, while we have no calls or texts right now, talking about money, there have been conversations and discussions about photovoltaics. And I want, and I have to do this every so often because these numbers keep coming up, and we need to be accurate about this stuff. If we're telling people what to do, we have to be able to represent things with the right numbers. So let's, and it was recently somebody said a solar panel, photovoltaic panel is $1,000. In what universe is this? It's not in my universe. A single solar panel does not cost $1,000 installed. Even installed, it's not $1,000. So let's backtrack. Let's start at the beginning. A single panel might be, we'll round it off. It's a 300-watt panel. That's what a lot of people are putting in these days. Okay? So the panel itself is, if you're paying $1 a watt for the panel, that's a strong number. It isn't going to be much. It should be $1 or less in my book if you shop it. That's just for the panel. It's going to give you something in DC, like let's say it puts out 24 volts DC or 48 volts DC. Okay, you can't use that in most applications. If you're off the grid and you're feeding batteries, you can. And we'll get to that in a moment. But most of the installations we're hearing about these days are grid-tied systems. So what do we need to tie to the grid? Well, the simple approach would be if you have a single panel, 300 watts, pay $1 a watt for it. It's $300 for that panel. It's not $1,000. It's $300. You can shop it. You can get online and shop the panel. Don't take my word for it. Look it up. Google is your friend. You would need an inverter that allows you to interface with the grid. And what that does, the electronic black box takes 24 volts or whatever voltage it is DC, inverts it to 110 or 220 volts AC. And that just hooks into a circuit breaker and a circuit breaker box, panel box. That's it. So what are you paying for? You're paying for a panel, $300. If it's an inverter for a single panel, it's called a microinverter, it's probably no more than 50 cents a watt. So that's $150. You're paying somebody to mount the panel on the roof. What does that cost? Or mount it somewhere. A single panel to mount is a nothing installation. So let's call it $100. So now we're up to what? $550. And if you're using an electrician, which you would if you're tying to the grid, what's the electrician going to charge to do one panel? He's going to charge pretty much the same as if he does 20 panels. Not quite, but close. So let's say that it's another $100 per panel, $650. Okay. So now we got a 300-watt panel doing something. Looking at numbers for our area, a 1,000-watt installation, which is roughly three of these panels, would deliver annually 1,100 kilowatt hours per panel, or excuse me, not per panel, but per 1,000 watts of installation. So a 300-watt installation would be 330 kilowatt hours a year. So let's round the number, let's call it 20 cents per kilowatt hour. Times what I say, 330. So that's $66 per panel per year. So you spent $650 and you're making back $66. Now, we're not talking tax credits. I'm not talking about anybody giving you any money to do anything. You've taken this out of your own pocket. You spent your own money straight in. $66 on a $650 investment. So it's a simple 10-year payback. It's 10% interest on your money. There's no moving parts. It's electronic. Yeah, the inverter might fail. The panel isn't going to fail unless somebody beats it with a baseball bat. And even then, sometimes they continue to work, but you'd want to replace it. So then if you enter into the equation, any kind of rebate, any kind of tax credits, the number changes, becomes better. I'm not a huge fan of rebates or tax credits, but if we're giving rebates for heat pumps, do we give rebates for solar? Do we give rebates? Do we give kickbacks to utility companies, to nuclear power? Yes. To fossil fuel industry? Yes. So what makes sense? I don't know. I'm not a policy guy. I don't want to talk about that. I don't enter tax credits into my thinking, A, because I'm not in a position to utilize those tax credits, which I just shared with you my personal, more personal information than I should, but I'm not in the situation where I'm apt to need it. Maybe I would be, but I'll probably, if I'm doing a system, I'm going to do it out of pocket, and I'm going to do it for as little as I can, and I can guarantee you, God is my witness, I'm not making this up. If I shop this, I'm going to be half of what I just told you. And you could even go lower than half. I mean, there's a lot of ways to have economies of this. So it's not that expensive. Does it make sense? I think so. Are numbers being thrown around? Yeah, I just threw some around. But I will tell you, you can get online and you can research this. I just told you the major components. If you're doing an off-grid system now with batteries and inverters and stuff, you're going to spend more money. But you're usually doing that because you're off the grid. You can't get a pole to you, or it's going to cost $10,000 a pole to get poles put in, and that's prohibitive. So for 10 grand, what can you do? I was listening to somebody who's saying, well, you know, we have the bare basics. We're measuring this and that and phantom loads, and well, you don't have a very big system, do you? And that's fine. You know, if that, but it's 2019. This technology has come a very long way. It's taken a long time. I'll be honest with you. I missed the boat on it. I have focused on solar heating and alternative heating for my whole energy career because A, it was simpler, and B, the economics did not make sense to do solar electric. That has flip-flopped completely. And one of the reasons it's flip-flopped is because there is the opportunity to store power with the, or share power with the utility. What's fair for the utility? I don't know. Again, we're into a policy issue. I think there's, as this market grows, the utility and the people who run the utility grid will make it work. If there's a cost sharing for the wires part of the system, it's gonna come into the equation. And we certainly don't want to be cheating the utility in terms of maintaining wires if you're grid tied. But by the same token, I expect in the next few years the on-site storage of power will be a lot more affordable than it is today. And right now it's not horrible, but it could be a lot better. Enough of that said. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. Our text line is 601-207-4478. The guy who bought 5 gallons of Wolex says, I have 4 boys. I assume they all are of driving age, so I guess that makes sense. And it doesn't smell, does it? I'm sure you opened the container and took a sniff. I'm tickled. If you haven't smelled fluid film, you need to do a comparison. There's a big difference there. Let's see. What else? I don't have it on the computer right now, but the Chinese have landed on the dark side of the moon. Okay. and the side that we can't see from Earth. And they have discovered what they claim is a gel-like substance on the surface of the moon. So I have to read this article. What's it, and so I read the article, and it sounds like it might be glass. You know, so molten, maybe some lava-related stuff that looks like gel. Well, you know, until you guys poke your robotic finger in it and it comes out like gel, don't call it gel. It's not gel. It's shiny. Let's call it shiny. That's what we can call it. Science. What is that all about? I mean, come on. Let's see. So the other project this week, I think I started last week. I got the lumber in for making forms for our building project. So I got the plywood on Tuesday when everybody's working again, and cut the plywood, and then it proceeded to sit till yesterday when I finished putting the forms together. And I have three forms. I have two forms that are 20 feet long and one form that is 16 feet long. And what it is a 2x4 top and bottom plate, 2x4, I'll call them studs. They're about 4 feet on center, not quite, but ballpark. It's going to be filled with concrete, so it just needs to hold everything, hold the top and bottom plate apart and hold the plywood in place. Inside of that, I'm going to cut and fit 1.5 inch or 2 inch foam, and then that will be put into the ground. We're going to do a 4 inch slab because this is for a crawl space. We don't really need a structural slab as such, but so we'll do a little digging when the rain stops, whenever that's going to be, and get the thing leveled up, and it'll be much straighter and much more level than the last one I did. And then we'll proceed to insulate and get ready to pour the concrete. But I was going to do it in pieces and assemble it on site, and I decided to make it in the shop, and it is now, I've got two things that are 20 feet long. and I've been considering the other things I've done driving up and down Route 1 this past week. I've been mulling over how to deliver this with a pickup truck. And I guess I do have a trailer. And I guess the practical and realistic and safe thing to do would be to put them on the trailer. It's not that big a deal. I'm not quite done yet, though. I finished sheathing it yesterday, and everything is pressure treated as wet, but it's in my shop. And I noticed yesterday the CDX plywood, the pressure treated CDX plywood, is drying on the surface, and I have it sitting. The forms are standing vertically, so the plywood is exposed on both sides, so it can dry. Because I want to cover the outside of the panel and the bottom plate with ice and water shield. So a piece of 3 foot wide ice and water shield cut down the middle will cover the 1 foot sidewall, so to speak, and the bottom. And what I'm going for here is some protection against leaching, against groundwater, rainwater, being up against this pressure-treated material, which would be susceptible to leaching as water runs across it. And if that happens, two things happen. One is we're removing the wood preservative from the wood, and the wood could rot. And the other thing we're doing is putting this material into the environment. It's mostly copper, but it is toxic to fish. So we don't want it leaching. And I'm not near enough to water that it's an issue. But let's keep it where it's supposed to be. It's easy enough to do. And I happen to have, for some reason, multiple rolls of ice and water shield that have been in my shop for ever. So I'll use some of those up. So it's going to dry for another day. I swept it off last night, got the sawdust off. But what I found is using ice and water shield Many times it doesn't stick real well. So, and this is the perfect day to do it if it's going to rain all day. We'll use some heat, a hot air gun, to put the ice and water shield in place and then heat it so the bitumen material bonds effectively to the wood and gives us what we want in terms of not coming off when I'm moving the thing around and getting it in the ground and all that other stuff. So we'll see. And we'll report back. By this time next week, I might have the forms in the ground, and I don't think I'll have poured the slab because that's the way the week goes. But it was a short week, and I had interruptions. So we're making strides here. Let's see. The phone number I'm going to give out now, we're going to take a break here in just a moment. The phone number, though, is 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. Okay, here's I got a text here. Tom, where do you find contractors who will come install solar panels that they didn't sell you for $100, electrician to hook you up for $100? Seems like these days you can't get anybody to get their truck in for less than $500. Everyone wants to make a percentage marking up on sales. That's true, very true. And that's per panel, okay? Usually you're putting in more than one 300-watt panel. You know, an average installation for photovoltaics is probably 5 kilowatts. So what's that, 20 panels? Let's say 20 panels. So now we're talking about $2,000 for each of those guys. All of a sudden, you've got their interest. Now, if you want to mount the panels yourself, you save $2,000 on that 5-kilowatt, 6-kilowatt system. The electrician, you have to have. Now, you got to do it safe. I think you'd get an electrician's attention for that kind of money. I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think you could. You might not get a solar installer, but it's 2019, and this stuff is out there, and you can do a lot of this yourself. You stop and think about it. The only thing that's complicated is the actual wiring hookup, and that's not that complex. But you do need to have an electrician to hook it up for dealing with the utility. So let's do that. I had something stuck in my head all week, and I have to get it out. and I put my head to one side, hit it like there's water in my ear, and it finally came out. And here it is. We're going to listen to it till we take the break because it's just one of those songs that I can't get away from. Okay, we're back. It's 9:06. It's hot and cold. It's Saturday morning. It's me, Tom, and buenos dias, amigos. Earth, Wind, and Fire. September. It's September. That's not right. 50 some degrees. Tropical storm, 50 degree weather. Who made these rules up? I don't know. Wasn't those guys. Anyway, our phone number, 1-800-966-1039, is the phone number to call into the radio show. We haven't had any phone calls this morning. Am I talking too much? Am I not making sense? Maybe that's what it is. Our text line, we got text coming in, 601-207-4478. Feel free to incorporate either of these into your lifestyle this fine Saturday morning. I've forgotten. I keep getting reminded, and the fact that, let's see, next Saturday, Martin Short and Steve Martin are going to be in Bangor, Maine. Now, you know, I look at all the concert stuff that goes on in town, and I regret not having gone to the Ringo Starr one. I mean, come on, it's Ringo Starr, Tom. But the rest is like, okay. But Martin Short and Steve Martin, I mean, there's going to be a banjo there. It's going to be at least one banjo. Steve Martin travels with more than one banjo. I just want you to know that. I keep track of these things more than most normal, rational thinking people would. So I don't know. I might just have to go. But right now we'll go to the phones at 1-800-966-1039. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hi. Hi. I have a question regarding insulating a floor.
Yeah.
In my my house upstairs, I use pellet stoves, so my furnace doesn't run that much.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to put some foam insulation on my underneath my floor so that the cold doesn't come up through the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was thinking was to use some of that 2-inch foam.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, would it make more sense to cut it and put it in between the bays, or should I, or can I just put a full sheet up over the tops of the bays and do it that way?
It would actually be easier and better to put it at the bottom of the floors and as full sheets, because the airspace you create actually has some insulation value. So that's a benefit. The catch is that the whole perimeter of the basement, where the sill meets the outside of the outside wall, that should be insulated as well, that little vertical area. And other than that, go ahead and do it.
Okay.
You'd be way ahead of the game.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Bye-bye. It does make a difference. And the other option would be to insulate the basement walls. You don't necessarily have to insulate them all the way down, but to insulate the basement walls would not be quite the same effect, but it would help. Let's see. I'm painting my house and it has aluminum siding. Should I use a brush or a roller? I would be inclined. I've never painted aluminum siding, so I can't tell you for sure. I would be inclined to use a brush. I don't think I think you're going to get a little bit of a texture on the finish. The other option would be to spray it. And one of these Wagner type sprayers would probably be adequate for that, because you do have a three-dimensional aspect to siding. But I would, if I was doing it, I would be doing it with a brush, which reminds me, I had, excuse me, what I guess I would call a commercial paint sprayer that I used very infrequently. I think I had used it once to spray some wicker furniture after I first got it, and then it sat for years. And, oh God, three, 4 years ago, I decided I'm going to paint my house. And I dug the thing out, and I said, okay, man, you know, I'm going to crank on this sucker. We're going to get this done so fast. And I set it up with the, you know, and I test it, turned it on, I hit the spray thing, and it, you know, paint comes out. And I start spraying. I was doing the back of the house. And I start spraying. You know, you squeeze a trigger, hold it in, and then you let go, and it stops spraying. I let go, and it wouldn't stop spraying. It stuck. The little dew flicker in the nozzle stayed stuck open. There was some schmutz in there from God knows when. And I kind of freaked out. I didn't know what to do. I wound up with like almost it was over an eighth of an inch of paint on the clapboard on the back of the house before I had the revelation, Tom, unplug it, which I did. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to use a brush. And I brushed out the eighth inch paint and it all worked out well. But anyway, let's go to the phones. 1-800-966-1039. Good morning again. Hot and cold. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Got another basement insulation question.
Sure,
for you. I was just seeking what you think the best way is. I'd like to use rigid foam, and if so, do I put that right against the wall, or should I do an air gap?
No air gap needed. I would put it right against the wall. You may have to mechanically fasten it. You know, folks have tried to glue to concrete walls, and concrete walls, although they look flat, aren't perfectly flat. So it may be you use something like a Tapcon and some strapping to hold it in place.
Okay.
But that would work fine. But you do not need an airspace.
All right, appreciate it. And by the way, love the show. Keep it going.
Okay, thanks. Bye bye.
Thank you.
We try. Got text here. Great bumper music. Well, thank you. We try. I'll go into bumper music some other time. Let's see. I heat with wood, have some cracks on outside masonry, no water damage. Quick fix. Quick fix would be a urethane caulk, or if you go to, you want to caulk on the outside, and I would go to the masonry aisle of the Home Depot and look for masonry caulk. In lieu of that, a urethane caulk would work. A urethane sticks to this kind of stuff, and it's resilient. But we want to keep water from getting into it, because if water gets into it and freezes, it's going to just kind of make that crack get bigger and bigger, and the bigger the crack gets, the more water gets in, more freezing, and eventually you have a crack you're not happy with. No, you shouldn't be happy with any cracks on a basement wall. You should fix them. So, over to line one we go. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning. Over the years, you've talked about putting some kind of a vapor barrier underneath a concrete pad. We're putting in a fifth or a double wide,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just wondering, foam board or is a plastic vapor barrier okay? Because it's just going to be a pad.
If it's a pad and you're not worried about, I mean, if the soils are good, the foam is not imperative. But then you know, 6 mil, 10 mil poly. I would use 10 mil poly if I'm going to, say, Home Depot and buying a roll of plastic. 10 mil is not that much more money, and it just gives you a little bit more protection, but that'll work fine.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. So the and I had the I'll tell you what. I got to take a break. Well, I'll make the comment. It's my radio show. I don't have to stop because it's 9:15. I could keep talking. We've had this conversation before, and I've had it with code guys, and you know, there's certain, if you're doing a building, a house on a slab, there's certain R values that they want to see. It's usually R10, and usual R10 comes from 2 inches of styrofoam. An inch and a half of urethane foam, of polyisofoam, will give you that same R value. In either case, you know, my concern has been, as one who has handled a lot of foam, and has and it's a numbers game, I think, but I've had the experience, usually on, if I've gotten in used foam, which we got on occasion, every so often you get a piece with ants in it. And, of course, you always wonder, how did they get there? Well, the more important thing is they're there. And I don't want to see ants in foam. So when we put foam on the ground, it becomes a little bit easier for them to get into it. So my sense is that if I'm doing foam on the ground, which I will be doing in a couple of weeks here, or within a week maybe, there will be a plastic, heavy-duty plastic vapor barrier down before the foam goes down. And then I'll put another layer on top of it. And in between those two layers with the foam, I'm also going to put in some Borateem laundry detergent. And the idea here is that, excuse me, especially at the perimeter where the critters are apt to get in, it is a barrier for ants. And the idea of the double layer is just to protect and keep the Borateem in place as long as possible. So for what it's worth, let's see. Oh, I want this one. I want this song. So we'll be back in a bit. Yeah, this is one that you got to hear. You got to hear it on Saturday mornings, and where else are you going to hear it? We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. It's 9:21. It's 9:22 already. It just went like that. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. It's me, Tom. It's the Voice of Maine. What else can I say? It's phone numbers. I could give the phone number, 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. If you'd like to call in this morning, right now, everything is wide open. 601-207-4478. We haven't seen a text in 11 minutes. My goodness. What's going on? Is things still working okay? I don't know. I think we're going to hear from Pete in a little while here, which is always an experience, if nothing else. The experience of dealing with my son, Pete. My eldest son bought a house recently and is in one of those black holes where you don't get good where he can get internet service, but he doesn't get good cell service. And he went to get the internet hooked up, and they said, "You have to cut trees before we can get." And he has underground service, but it comes overground for a little while, and he wound up with a tree service pruning a bunch of trees. I didn't ask him what he did with the wood, if he saved the wood or not, because I got a truck and I got a wood stove. So you never know. Let's go to the phones at 1-800-966-1039. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Hello.
Good morning, Eric. Is this Tom?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Very good. My name is Jim there, and we're in the process of building a large, a small camping cabin that is totally off-grid. Mm-hmm. And I'm also in the process of hooking up 9 300-watt solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes time to running this approximately 150, 200 feet into the dwelling there, having an issue there with the controllers and that sort of thing, that it's going to go up. And my electronic or electrical experience there is rather limited. And I was just wondering if you have any pointers there other than calling it a professional.
Well, you can get a lot of good guidance on builditsolar.com. In terms of sizing things, the first and most critical aspect of this is just having the right size wire for running the power line, so to speak, from the panels to the house. I'm assuming all your panels are going to be hooked up in parallel, so that would be number one, all the positives, all the negatives together,
right,
to give you that given voltage. So if you've got 9 300-watt panels, that's 2,700 watts. If you're running 24 volts, you conceivably are running 100 amps at peak power, which is a
right.
lot of power. And
right, we're doing a 48-volt system.
Okay, so that's 50 amps, and that's good. The higher the voltage is, the wire size can be a little bit smaller. You know, you have to have wire that's capable of handling 50 amps comfortably. And then when you get into the building, you would have a charge controller that's rated for 48 volts at something more than 50 amps. And then, of course, your battery bank, which has to be also appropriately sized. So that's sort of the basic thumbnail. In the midst of all this, you need fuses and/or circuit breakers to protect you and anybody who might be near it. And then you go on from there.
Yeah, we've been dealing with a company there, and we've got the basic stuff there. Quite a large expense, I may say. But one of the other issues that came up also was some type of a controller for a well pump. Now, we also installed a soft start well pump, which I believe is dedicated just, you know, not just for solar, but it's popular in the solar use there. Once again, this is totally upgrade. We're not tied into the utility companies at all or anything like that.
Right.
I just got this casing put into the ground here. I'm waiting for the cement to cure before I mount these massive solar panels on here and then try to trench a line in. Direct burial 8-gauge wire is what I've come up with so far.
Sounds about right.
You know, so, but there again, running at 150, possibly 175 foot, I know I'm going to have some loss there.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, you can get online and look at the, I'm sure if it's not on Build It Solar, you can also look up the carrying capacity of the given gauge wire and what size conduit you would need to have. It doesn't have to be a very big conduit, surprisingly, for running that. 8-gauge sounds about right, but just from having looked recently, I would double check it just to be sure. 150 feet is a little bit of a run, but it's not out of the question.
Right. So would you advise that to be put inside a conduit piping also? It is, being that it's going to be buried in semi-sandy, rocky soil.
I like conduit a lot. The older I get, the more I like having some wiggle room. Right. And with conduit, you have the opportunity to run new wire if you need to. And, you know, I came across this thing just looking around a conduit recently. I've got to run some Category 5 cable for internet stuff, and I want to do it underground. And I was looking at conduit and the like, and guys who do this regularly will use something like a shop vac and I guess they call it a plug with a string on it, and you put the shop vac on it, and it will actually suck the string through the conduit, so you don't have to snake it as you're putting it in. I just love the concept of doing that. I'm dying to do it. A friend of mine told me that you can buy these plugs, electrical places or find them online. But a friend of mine told me that he had an electrician who did it, and he used a plastic bag like you would get at the supermarket.
Yep.
And tie it to the string, and it does the same thing. So I'm going to try both. I've got to get a little mini backhoe in and get the trenches dug and put the conduit in.
If you have a straight run, I would think that would work straight if you had a straight run and it wasn't 150.
Well, here's the deal. I was just shopping different size conduits and the like, and I think I'm going to use flexible conduit, like Liquitite. And it's amazing how much carrying capacity you can get in a 3/4 inch piece of conduit. My inclination was to use like 1 inch or even 1.5 inches, just because, you know, more seems better, and it's not very expensive. And so I've got to make that decision at some point soon.
Yeah. But keep those critters there from chewing out wire up there also.
Yeah. Yeah. That. Well, you know, I think you got to be down 2 feet. That's not too bad of digging, even where we are. But if you've got sandy soil, especially if you've got some rocks in it, I think conduits, a cheap date, considering, you know, if something's going to happen, it'll happen in January.
I got you. Well, this is Maine, as you know, Darren, and not just rocks there. These things are boulders.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I appreciate the heads up and your information out there. I love your show.
Okay, thanks. Take care now. Good luck. Right, keep us posted, too. Appreciate hearing back. We got to take a break. It is 9:30, straight up. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, it's hot and cold Saturday morning, 9:36, and we got on line number 3 here, the Tom Jones of Stockton Springs, Maine, Pete Gozy. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, everyone. Don't ever compare me to Tom Jones. I'd appreciate it.
Why not?
I don't like Tom Jones.
Oh, man.
I mean, I'm not saying he's not a good singer. I don't know. It's just too...
He's too old for you.
It's lounge music.
Lounge music? That's the best kind of music there is. I mean... So what's shaking, now, Pete?
I really think we're going to have to sit down and figure out what the buffer music is going to be when I call in, because I'm not liking what I'm hearing so far.
Oh, boy. You ain't, well, you ain't heard nothing yet. You just give me another week or so. Let's choose some buffer. How about this?
No, I don't know what that is, but no.
How about this one? You recognize that song?
No. I recognize it, but yeah, no.
Okay, not that one.
We're getting warmer, but no.
All right. I'll work on it. I tell you.
Okay.
Well, here's the good. Well, how about this? This is cool, Pete.
He's just gonna keep doing this.
The Pete Gozy theme music.
Oh.
Ah. Huh?
No, that's no good.
All right. We'll stop.
Okay.
So what's up?
You know, I'm looking out the window here, and given the temperature and the precipitation and the fact the wind is picking up, I'm starting to think I'm not going to sell any cars today. I've got two umbrellas, though, if anybody does want to come in and look at something.
We might even give the person the umbrella. We have a duck head umbrella.
Anybody that comes in and buys a car today, I'm going to give you both of these moderate umbrellas. They both open.
I don't know if you should give them both away, but...
I'm going to give them both away. We are going crazy here. The Foreman grill is gone. Did I mention that last week?
You did.
What's
yeah.
That? Okay. That, yeah. That grill's gone.
That's gone.
Yeah. So we're down to umbrellas. And what has Maria got over here? There's some gum. You can have Maria's gum too.
Maria has. You could look in the file cabinet too. She has some stuff. Some of your eatables, maybe. Ginger.
I don't. What is this? That's some sort of hippie candy. I don't.
Yeah.
No. There's a box of forks.
Yeah. No forks. Those are mine.
So, interesting occurrence last night. I got a technical question for you about dehumidifiers.
Okay.
So, last night it was a little bit cool in the house, and I, you know, it's we're getting into that weird buffer time where it's like It's not cold enough to run heat, but it's definitely not comfortable. Mm. So I figure I'll pop the dehumidifier on. Mm-hmm. You know, we got the rain coming in tomorrow. It'll pull a little bit of humidity out of the air, throw a little bit of heat out. Mm-hmm. So I do that. I turn it on. I'm not paying attention. I'm in the other room watching something. I start to smell something. It smells kind of weird. I get up. I go out. The whole house is in a haze. It's not smoke. It's not smoke, though. It's water vapor. Like, it smells like a humidifier is running. So I go and I turn off the dehumidifier. It's hot. I unplug it. I check the reservoir. Thing is bone dry. Not a drop of water in it.
Hmm.
So apparently it was humidifying instead of dehumidifying.
You broke the dehumidifier is what you're
saying. Well, yeah. What I did was, this is a man thing, is I left it right where it was in the house because that way if it caught on fire, I'd know. I was going to put it out in the shop. I said, no, I'm going to leave it right here. So this way, if it catches on fire, I'll know about it.
That's my boy.
Logic for you.
Yeah.
So I waited until I was sure it wasn't going to catch on fire, and then I put it out in the shop.
Yeah.
So we can take that apart later, I guess, since we're not going to have anything else to do.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, well.
So did you tell everybody about the lift?
I didn't tell them the part about when you came over on Thursday, when right, that was over.
Okay, yeah.
I figured I'd leave that story for you.
So the lift shows up on Wednesday. We get it unpacked. It's very heavy, very heavy. Lots of heavy parts. There's a mast for it, the single post. It's like 340 pounds, 8 feet tall. It's bulky, it's heavy, and all that. So last thing I said Wednesday, because usually I'm off Thursdays, is I said, don't put it together. We'll put it together on Friday. You're going to get hurt. So naturally, Thursday, I run off to the store. I come back. He's in there with Nat from Brad. I don't even know what his business's name is. Bradshaw Machinery?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yep.
Best machine shop in the state right there.
Yes, sir.
He's over here, and they've got to come along, hooked to the roof truss of our building, and they're hoisting it up, and they've got the thing resting on the tailgate to the truck at like a 45-degree angle. These two guys with a combined age of about 190 and a similar combined weight, and they're trying to put this 348-pound, 8-foot mast up in the air. So naturally, I go in and I'm grumbling. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm both going to die, and yeah, I'm going to help do this. So I immediately pull a board out that I'm not supposed to pull out. Whole thing slides about 4 inches.
That was exciting.
Woke everybody right up.
Yeah.
But we got it up. We got it all standing upright, and nobody lost a foot.
So well, you know, probably three of us could have just picked it up. But, you know, if you live in Maine, you have to have a come-along. And I had one, but I broke it, so... I asked Nat if I could borrow his. He says, do you want the good one or the one you broke? I'm like, he claims that I broke one of his come-alongs, which is possible. I might have. But I think it was broken before I was given it, and then he had repaired it, and then it kind of bent again. But
okay, so it was broken, then it was fixed, and then you broke it, but you're questioning whether or not you broke it.
Right, because it was broken before and then was repaired in a way that I don't think was appropriate. They're not that well built anyway. You know, come-alongs are a cheap come-along is not a very high quality piece of equipment. But
okay, so you see where my concern is with you guys lifting a 340-pound, you know, giant steel 8-foot mast in the air with a come-along. You're putting an awful lot of faith.
Well, no, you left out that part. I also had two straps around it. I had three. So 3 points
when the
of
come along, let go. This way, it could swing around on the straps.
Yeah, and take
like a pencil, knocking Hungarians and whatever Nat is over. And
Nat is the son of a preacher man. His father was a minister, if you can believe that. Right. Yeah,
good deal.
Yeah, so he's not quite sure what happened to him, but
I was gonna say, but that's all right.
But yeah so anyway, but we got the thing up and got it bolted in place. And the rest of it went together pretty quick. It wasn't that complicated, and it's not quite done, but it will be done today.
Yeah.
So.
And then we'll be able to lift cars in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's...
What could be safer?
If I have a come-along, I think we'll be perfectly safe. So...
Are we calling in? What are we doing today?
I don't know. We're just... let's see. I got any text messages? Oh, we got a couple of text messages here. Let's see. This is a pictorial one, Pete. It says, good morning, Tom. I was curious if you could tell me how big a problem we might have. Might be done to fix it. We're trying to sell our house, so I have trouble finding someone that... I don't know what that is. Oh. Oh, he's got cracks. Well, it's cinder
cracks
block.
What?
It's a cinder block wall that was block bonded. And, okay. Yeah, that looks kind of...
What is block bonded?
Block Bond is Block Bond was a fiberglass reinforced concrete, so you would just stack cinder blocks up, and then you put this stuff over the face on both sides, and it supposedly held it together, and it worked fair. And that's I can't tell.
This feels like a 70s product.
It is a 70s product. Very good, Pete. You picked out your 70s stuff right away. I would say that from the pictures I'm seeing here, you want to get somebody, either you or somebody, to patch. You got cracks. Some of it is block. Some of it is reinforced concrete, I think. It's kind of hard to tell from the photos, but it may be on the inside. I would consider spray foaming it. On the outside, I'd consider skim coating it with a repair mortar. If you're trying to sell that, you've got to get it done before somebody comes to inspect it, because the way it looks right now, you're going to get hit either way. You're going to pay either before or after the sale. Also got a text message here that says, "Hi, Pete." We got another one. It's a modular on poured concrete. The cinder block is where the beam to lower the house went. Okay, so then I would consider, maybe getting a skim coat to go over it, and some repair stuff to repair, mortar to, and you'll have to prime the surfaces with the, basically it's like a latex primer you brush on, and to ensure that you get a good bond between the two. That'd be what I would be doing. Let's see. We got a phone call coming in too, Pete. Let's see. We'll go over to line one. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I heard Tom talking about solar earlier.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm off-grid. I've lived on solar for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I first put in four 240-watt panels.
Mm-hmm.
And it was $250 a piece. Last year, I bought a 335-watt panel for $250.
Right.
I'm putting in another one this year, and I have a friend who helps me hook things up. He's lived on solar for 30 years. His panels are still putting out 95%.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So you don't have to kill your panels at 10 years. Your batteries don't go 2 or 3 years. Mine are 10 years old, still mm-hmm. working fine.
Good.
So as far as a grid tie, it's foolish. It's nothing but a ripoff. Talk to somebody who lives on solar and then make your decision. Okay?
Good. I appreciate your call. Thank you. And thanks for doing what you did. The numbers, the numbers work. There's a lot of varying degrees here in terms of doing a solar project like this. The extreme is going to be if you go to a contractor and say, "I want a system." I can tell you from experience that from what other people have told me, a lot of contractors don't even want to talk to you unless it's a big system. Because they're doing huge systems right now. So they're making more money on, if we're talking about a cost of an individual panel installed, if they're doing, say, 50 or 100 panels for something, the economics there are way more attractive to them than doing 10 panels on your house. And the biggest issue in terms of cost for labor is just mounting the panels. And you don't need to know hardly anything to do that properly. You have to know what kind of caulk to use. You need to know what kind of hardware to mount. You don't have to get exotic hardware. And the cost can be extremely low. So if you're a do-it-yourselfer, go to builditsolar.com, and you can find a lot of information there that goes in with pictures. Gives a lot more detail than I can, in a few moments we have every Saturday. I'm just, as the caller said, the economics are really good right now, and they're not going to change. And I also can tell you from people I've spoken to that we sold tanks to for heating systems, for solar heating systems. They have, when you do a heating system, you got circulator pumps, you got all these odds and ends that can fail. He said, you know, when I do a photovoltaic system as a contractor, I don't get any callbacks. Nothing breaks. Yeah, enough said.
I think part of what attracts people to grid-tied systems, though, is sort of the belt and suspenders aspect of it. The same way some people only like turnkey houses or cars that are less than 5 years old. It's just having that extra, you know, knowing that if there's a problem with the power, you can always go back to the power company and say, hey, come fix this.
Absolutely.
You know, the systems are foreign, and they're just, you know, they're not familiar with them yet.
And you know, Pete, the thing is that the grid-tied system, I don't think will go away. I think it makes sense to be grid-tied because there's times you'll have excess capacity. And if you can get that into the grid and there's some economics there that makes sense, so much the better. And if you have some even petite storage on site, if the grid goes down, you've got the system still functioning. And I don't think it's going to be petite storage forever. I think it's going to be substantial storage as the technology improves, and it is improving. And that will still stay grid-tied, but give you the opportunity to be hybrid. So you could either be grid-tied or independent, depending on what's happening in terms of the cost of everything. So all good. Let's see. We got time for another call here. Oh, no, we don't. That one went away. You got somebody there?
No, it's just Pat Barry. He's looking at the Hyundai.
Oh, okay.
Son-in-law's interested in it.
Okay.
He came by to see if he could win an umbrella.
Oh, okay. Let's go over to line one. Good morning. You're on The Voice of Maine.
Hi, good morning. How's it going today?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. I wanted to talk a little bit about the foam insulation on sidewalls.
Sure.
I built a few houses where you put it on the outside, and that's just a pain in the neck to get it all sealed up and watertight.
Mm-hmm.
Doing an addition on my home, and I'm considering either putting studs up, 1 inch of foam, then sheathing, or just adding like 4 inches of blue board between the joists, or the studs rather,
mm-hmm.
like you normally would.
Yeah. I like the idea of framing it up and putting a layer of foam and then putting the sheathing over it.
Okay.
It decouples all the framing. I've had the conversation with code guys about racking. They're concerned the building's going to rack. I think if you're using sheet goods, probably it's not going to rack, but it's easy enough to put metal strap on the corners, you know, cross strapping, before you put the foam and the sheathing on. And that protects you from any racking issue, because if you think about it, let's say you're putting even 2 inch foam on the outside of the building, and then you've got a 3 inch or a 4 inch screw, and you're screwing your siding on, you're compressing the foam. I don't think you're going to see the building kind of moving on that 2 inch length of fastener that is in the foam. But it's easy enough to, especially with an addition, just to get some strapping in there to keep it secure.
Do you think if I used a 1 inch blue board and then conventional fiberglass insulation or something, that's enough to stop condensation, or do I really need 2 inches of foam between?
You need the my understanding, and it seems to hold true. I've had this from several sources, is R10 is what you need. So that would be inch and a half of polyiso or 2 inches of styrofoam.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And then fiberglass in the cavity and you're home free.
Good deal. Sounds great.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks, sir.
All right, bye-bye. And that's exactly what we're doing at our shop, Pete, is inch and a half on the outside.
It is. If you go by today, you'll see the inch and a half on the outside. We've left it exposed for several weeks so people can get ideas on how to do it for themselves.
That's right.
We're generous. We're generous with our building science.
That's right. We don't want to cover it up too quick. Because if we do that, then you say, well, what do I do? And you know, now you just walk out the door. You stand in the door. You don't even have to go outside, Pete, because it's raining. You can stand in the doorway and point at it as people drive by.
I know.
And this
way it looks like we're always doing something. We're always in the middle of a project.
Well, we kind of are, but I bet we're the only used car dealership in the state of Maine that has inch and a half foam on the outside of their office, too.
I bet you we are.
Do you ever think about that?
We're probably the most handsome person.
That's probably true, Pete.
We got faces for radio.
Yeah. I think we got time for one more call here before the end of the hour. Good morning. You're on The Voice of Maine.
Tom. I'm thinking about building some sporting camps on the Penobscot River.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering is, what do you think about a small heat pump for AC in the summer and some heat during the fall, maybe not for total winterizing, to cut down on propane tanks, number two tanks?
Yeah, I mean, if you have any hint of insulation in the building, probably a mini split would do fine for you. If it's reasonably well insulated, a mini split is apt to carry the building in four seasons.
Yeah, I was thinking about spray foam. I was going to put it on post, but probably 12 inches of spray foam under the floor and 6-inch walls.
Okay, yeah, mini split is fine. I without running any numbers, and somebody would size the heat pump for you anyway. I don't think you have any issues with comfort and carrying the building year round.
Like for a 20x28 building.
Yeah, we got to run numbers, but I think it would be pretty good. You'd be
probably the cheapest overall instead of putting oil tanks or propane tanks.
Yep, I agree.
Everything off electricity because the power's already run in.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I would do.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're
welcome. Appreciate it. Love your show.
Thanks.
I like the sound of those R values.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure 12 inches is imperative under the floor, but then again, it depends how far up the penobscot you are. And Pete, I just noticed we're out of time.
Uh-oh.
I got to hit the music real quick. You know, I get so excited when I'm talking to you on the weekend that I lose track.
Who could blame you?
I know. We'll see you all next week. Thanks for calling in, Pete.
All right.
See ya.